हरिः ॐ सहनावतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यं करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधर शिव सरि गौर भक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Okay, page 113. Sukadev Goswami continued. Lord Ramachandra's reputation for having killed Ravana with showers of arrows at the request of the demigods and for having built a bridge over the ocean does not constitute the factual glory of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Lord Ramachandra, whose spiritual body is always engaged in various pastimes, Lord Ramachandra has no equal or superior, and therefore he had no need to take help from the monkeys to gain victory over Ravana. Srila Prabhupada comments. As stated in the Vedas, Svetasvatara Upanishad 6.8, the Supreme Lord has nothing to do and no one is found to be equal to or greater than him, for everything is done naturally and systematically by his multifarious energies. The Lord has nothing to do. Natasya karyam karanam cha vidyate. Whatever he does is his pastime. The Lord has no duty to perform, to oblige anyone. Nonetheless, he appears to act to protect his devotees or kill his enemies. Of course, no one can be the Lord's enemy, since who could be more powerful than the Lord? There is actually no question of anyone being his enemy. But when the Lord wants to take pleasure in pastimes, he comes down to this material world and acts like a human being, thus showing his wonderful, glorious activities to please the devotees. His devotees always want to see the Lord's victorious in various activities, and therefore, to please himself and them, the Lord sometimes agrees to act as a human being and perform wonderful, uncommon pastimes for the satisfaction of the devotees. And so, what the Lord's doing, that's not the specialness. He always knew it was you, right? So that's not the specialness. The specialness is that he is beyond all this. He's, you know, the power behind everything. Everything goes on just because he wants it to. That's all. That's his. But even more special than that is that he does all these activities simply to please the devotees. Right? Yes.
Special from whose point of view? His or ours?
It says both.
Because if...
It means it pleases them, so it pleases him to please them.
Who is him? Who, when... Say him. How does one relate to that?
Him.
Yes.
Means... it means when we're talking about the Lord, and then we use the pronoun him, then it means the Lord.
Okay. I'm sorry, I got lost.
Okay. So, we're dealing with the Supreme Lord. So his wonderfulness is not the activities he performs, because his energies can carry those out. You know, just by his desire those happen. So the specialness is his interaction with the devotees and doing these things to please the devotees. That's the specialness, yes.
Someone was making a point about not being inimical. Is it then the inimical nature is not on the person but it's on the position? Because there is the inimical nature here in the material world. Inimical towards
no, but it's talking about the Lord. How can anyone be his enemy? Because he is the power of the person who's seemingly envious. So where's the enemy? Hmm. Enemy means someone who can give you trouble. No one can give him trouble. You know? Does that make sense? Hmm. Yeah, so that's the whole thing, is that there's nothing that anybody can do to disturb him. So he has no enemy. But for the pleasure of the devotees, then he comes and performs pastimes in which it attracts the minds of the devotees. And because it's interacting with the devotees, he's happy to do that. So he becomes pleased by this also. Does that make sense? Yeah. So the whole point is we take it that the knowledge, the skill, the endeavor, the result that's gained, that's the real specialness. That's the wonderfulness. Right? But actually, that's not the wonderfulness, because that he just carries out through his energies. What's the wonderfulness is the relationship with the devotees and interacting with the Lord devotees based on that affection. That's special. Does that make sense? Yes.
So basically we can say that Krishna consciousness is all about experience.
Yes.
But then we see the difficulty is that we have material experience and we don't have the spiritual experience. So we're trying to fake it.
It's not faking it, because anything done connected to Krishna is real. And that's the natural thing to do, is Krishna consciousness. So it's not actually faking it. Means you have, there's this interesting kind of quasi-intellectual, slightly thoughtful, slightly liberal, interactive with others position that the modern society projects. You know, and the more you go towards the Anglo-Saxon, the stronger that is. So then, this idea is that if you're not just what comes into your mind, letting yourself go, then it's not natural. But the point is just reacting like an animal, that's not the state of naturalness. That's natural for an animal. But for a human being, their uniqueness is their ability to apply the intelligence to something higher than simply just what the senses dictate. So even though these individuals will pride themselves in having a bit of a philosophy and, you know, being thoughtful, they're only thoughtful in the line of how to be an animal. And at the same time, if you just do what you feel like, they'll get offended because you're not considering everybody else there, so you're restricting yourself. But the point is the restriction that's in connection with them, that's the only real natural restriction. So if they feel like you should let it go, then you should let, and if they feel it shouldn't, then you shouldn't. So they dictate the social standards. Well, if we say that there's something coming from religion, something from tradition, something from philosophy, authority, then that's unnatural because that's been opposed, you know, imposed. But somehow or another, their rules are not imposed. They're just standard. So that's the funny part of this group. Their false ego is immense. And their self-worth that they feel is immense. But because they support each other, they feel that they're really cool. But rule number one, never say this to that group of people. They'll be extremely, extremely offended. Like that. Because they're not as thoughtful as they think. You know, so they basically, their right is to be offended by everybody else and what they feel, that's actually the standard by which all things should be measured. Right? So as that group grows, you know, because it's the middle class, when there's peace, that group always grows. Then these kind of not dysfunctional social elements come up. But as there's unrest, then this group disappears, and then it goes back into either the poor or the rich, who are generally more practical. You know, not that there shouldn't be a middle class. It's just without training, then they actually, you know, just become a problem. Does that make any sense, or did we get too much off on a tangent?
Therefore, it's not faking it.
Yes, that's the point. Therefore, Krishna consciousness is not faking it. That group, though, considers anything but what they're doing faking it. That's the funny part about that group. Like that. So it's not about the individual. They say it's all about the individual. It's absolutely not about the individual. It's about fitting into what is defined as what's an individual.
That's about individual, about them.
Yeah, well, yeah, okay. The individual is a them, okay. That's being individualistic means what they think. So the that's the whole point of sadhana, is we're getting used to the idea of what is actually we're supposed to be doing. You know, just like, let's say, children, they're supposed to learn. So, but it may take them a little while to get adjusted to going to school. But that doesn't mean school's unnatural. It just means it takes some time to adjust to whatever is proper. You know, just let's say, like, a new diet. One's eating in a particular way, one's getting sick, different diets recommended. In the beginning, that diet's a problem. But as you go, it gets better. Right? So what we're used to is the mode of passion, where we see immediately results, though it'll turn into a disaster at the end. While with the mode of goodness, it will be, you know, it seems like a disaster in the beginning, but it becomes very good at the end. So that's what takes getting used to, is shifting from the mode of passion perspective to the mode of goodness perspective. Yes.
Just a practical question. When we find the shift...
Sorry, that wasn't practical.
No, that's even more practical.
Okay.
When we find the shift to mode of goodness, will results come faster?
When we shift to the mode of goodness, will the results come faster? It means if we actually shift to the mode of goodness, let's say that the results will come... What is it even? Parabolically? It means it builds. So it'll start off a little bit flat, and then it'll start up and get... So you just have to wait. But when it results come, because of the steadiness, it builds. It's like Ayurvedic medicine. It's not you take the medicine, it has the results. It's by building. Then it starts to have that force.
How long?
Well, from the previous chapter, Katvanga Maharaj, then we had one moment. Like that. And then after that, it's up to you. It can take a little longer than that. It can take one lifetime, which is recommended. It can take many lifetimes.
Durvasa Muni
can take even a little longer. So the point is also the mode of goodness. If we establish the mode of goodness, then we're not impatient, so then we're not worried.
Like that. But in the material world, there is no pure mode of goodness?
In the material platform, there's no pure goodness. But you can get more goodness of goodness. But you can just like in goodness, you can have goodness with, you know, it's predominantly goodness, then goodness with passion, goodness with ignorance. Like that. But it's just a matter of, it's predominantly goodness. But when we take up devotional service, then one can function in pure goodness. So then at that point, the passion ignorance goes. That's why we put so much emphasis on giving up the desire for sense gratification, because that's what gets in the way of devotional service. It's not engaging the senses that gets in the way. It's the concept that I will enjoy from this rather than Krishna will enjoy from this. Because Krishna consciousness means it's about Krishna enjoying. And material life means it's about I'm enjoying. So that's the whole point of the regulation and everything, is to control the senses so that we can make this distinction.
Would it be correct to say that all natures in all the varnas, when they are purified enough, they can function on the level of mode of goodness?
Yes, but the principle that can get all varnas and ashrams working in the platform of goodness efficiently is pure goodness, is devotional service. Because if you're engaged in pure goodness, goodness is already included. It doesn't mean that the activity itself won't be governed by that particular mode, but it just means we will not be under that mode. Does that make sense? Okay. Let us say, it's a play on words, but it may get the point across. Okay, the doctor is performing an operation with a knife. So he's working with the knife. But the patient, he's said to be under the knife. Do you understand? So that's the point, is that we work with the modes, but we're not affected by the modes. Because the modes are what manage this here. So it's not that we can work with something else. Is that make sense? Yeah. Okay. Sukadev Goswami continued, Lord Ramachandra's spotless name and fame, which vanquish all sinful reactions, are celebrated in all directions, like the ornamental cloth of the victorious elephant that conquers all directions. Great saintly persons like Markandeya Rishi, still glorify his characteristics in the assemblies of great emperors like Maharaj Yudhishthira. Similarly, all the saintly kings and all the demigods, including Lord Shiva and Lord Brahma, worship the Lord by bowing down with their helmets. Let me offer my obeisances unto his lotus feet. Lord Ramachandra returned to his abode, to which bhakti yogis are promoted. This is the place to which all the inhabitants of Ayodhya went after they served the Lord in his manifest pastimes, by offering him obeisances, touching his lotus feet, fully observing him as a father-like king, sitting or lying down with him like equals, or even just accompanying him. O King Parikit, anyone who orally receives the narrations concerning the characteristics of Lord Ramachandra's pastimes will ultimately be freed from the disease of envy and thus be liberated from the bondage of fruitive activities. Srila Prabhupada comments, here in the material world, everyone is envious of someone else. Even in religious life, it is sometimes found that if one devotee has advanced in spiritual activities, other devotees are envious of him. Such envious devotees are not completely freed from the bondage of birth and death. So that means even though they're envious, they progressed. But it's just they're not completely freed, right? So they're you know, some degree of freed, but not totally, because that envy is still there. So it's not that, oh, if any bad qualities are there, they can't be a devotee. It just means if any bad qualities are there, they're not yet come to the liberated platform. Yes.
There's the famous shloka, people are free from the propensity to criticize. So can you say something, what's that propensity? Like here, is the propensity to criticize, to find faults.
Yes.
So how can a conditioned living entity ever become free from that propensity?
When one doesn't see the qualities that other has separate from the Lord. Right.
So one admires them. Right?
Yes, because anybody. That's why that was the point of Yudhishthira Maharaj, is that because he sees everything in connection with the Lord, therefore every living entity found he had some good quality, because every living entity has something special they can do. So he was appreciative of some good quality. While Duryodhana, because he sees nothing in connection with the Lord, he couldn't find any good quality. Because the position of finding fault, the agenda behind it is that if I find a fault in, means something has a fault, means it's, you know, it's of less value, you know, or something defective. While that the person who can find the fault is considered, they'll consider themselves in the superior position. So the real point of fault finding is it feeds my own ego. So I'm the controller and enjoyer. So if I can find fault in everybody else, then that puts me in the better position. That's what's behind it. People will say, no, I'm just trying to help and this and that. But the point is much of the time, who asked them to help? You know? They've just, what do you call it, the self-appointed, you know, criticizer of everybody in the universe. You know, what's the point? No, there's no need. You know, there's no effect, there's no, because it's not coming from purity. Means if purity means it's said, it has effect. Or at least one thinks about it, and, you know, it has, there's some thought. But just to criticize, and that, then there's no real benefit. Yes, means if those who are being criticized are under the responsibility of that, but let's say the analyst is supposed to analyze this particular thing, then his analyzation of it then is not a problem. But if that's not the case, then what's the point? And then even the analyst does it, it's not his business to affect it. So he just gives the information, and once he's analyzed, then he's not analyzing anymore. Right? So, but if one is in a responsible position, then those under him, then some fault may be found if it's beneficial for them to improve the quality of their devotional service. But otherwise, if it's just a fault just because you can find it, then what's the benefit? Is that okay? Yes.
It seems that, you know, some people see only faults, and some people see faults, but this is not their focus. And some devotees, they don't even see any fault, they just see good qualities.
Yes.
So is this according to the level of consciousness, or it's just natural?
There'll be the aspect of consciousness, but also then you'd have to define in that who doesn't see any faults between someone who's sentimental and who doesn't see any faults because they only see everything connected to the Lord. But the practical thing is to see the good qualities, but see whatever weaknesses are there that gets in the way of that, so that it can be, if needed, it can be helped. But otherwise, if it's not necessary, then there's no need to see the faults. Right, so whatever will be of value to inspire the individual in Krishna consciousness, that's then what is seen. So if the mood is very good in that, then one's cultivating that. If there's some weakness in there, one might look at some other aspects. So just like, let's say, for example, the person comes to the temple, you know, very new, and they're, you know, wearing whatever dress they wear. But you'll see the mood is that of inquisitiveness, wanting to know what's going on, and this and that. It has nothing to do with their dress. So for them, even though you could say is that particular dress might not be ideal, but it's not seen as a fault, because the mood is simply trying to understand Krishna consciousness, being involved, and this and that. So you keep on that point, and you never even refer to the other. But if you see one day, then they're thinking about their dress or comparing their dress to, or things like that, at that point then you point it out, because now it's a fault. Does that make sense? You know, so if there's no identity with a fault, then there's no need to deal with it. But if there's an identity with it, then it becomes a fault that has to be adjusted. So that's why we say, we're Westerners, we have to do, it's already a fault. As soon as you said we're wet, then that, you know, it's a fault. Because it's an identity. But if it's, we're servants of Krishna, so therefore we engage in, you know, whatever way is best to be fully engaged, body, mind, and words, now we're dealing with something solid. Because we're starting with the Krishna conscious, then we're moving back. So if there is some material needs and that's addressed based on that platform. So it's not that we have upadis and then we're adding Krishna, it's about Krishna and then we're considering our upadis. How to engage them, how to deal, how important are they? You know, if they're not important, we drop them or, you know, move in that direction, or if they are, then we work how to engage them. But if we start with upadis, and then, you know, we'll add Krishna, how our upadis appreciate, then you're not going to end up with a whole lot. You know, then you end up with someone who, you meet them on the street, and you have out your, what do you call those? You know, the board with the clip. Clipboard, yeah. Clipboard, yes, okay. So, we have the clipboard, and okay, we're doing a survey and that, you know, how do you identify yourself with any particular religion or not, or what it is, and then they go, yes, Hare Krishna. Okay, thank you. And then go on to the next one. But other than that, you don't see them do anything. Right, so like that, we have what, 2 billion Christians. There's a good chance that 1 billion of them are like that. You know, so it's okay if you mention, oh yeah, no, he's a nice guy, cool beard, like the robes, you know, like that. Huh? No, I'm talking about the Christians. Has to have a beard. Have you ever seen Jesus without a beard? He's got to have a beard. Right?
Yeah, it was hard.
Huh? Yeah.
It was hard to shave them.
It was hard to shave them, yeah. Take a rock. Yeah, yeah, so. You know, so it's all about, you know.
It's all about the beard.
It's all about the beard. That's the funny thing. The beard and the robes is okay. You know, 2 billion people worship a guy like that. We come out with a beard and robes, and hey, what's the weird guy doing? You know, it's like, you know, what do you mean? Yes.
How do we avoid this one size fits all mentality in this whole kind of purview that everything should be in this kind of?
That's what we're working on here. That was what we were mentioning, is the ninth canto. It's we're working on that one size fits all concept, because we can see as different devotees, different situations, how they deal with things are not necessarily the same. So there is the exceptions. Like that. Because if we say one size fits all, means it's not well thought out. Like that. Does that make sense? So, it's means it may be that one goes into it, that one sees a situation, one functions on that, but as soon as one gets other information that it's different, then he adjusts. Then that's fine. But if it's no, if information is different, but you stick to the thing of no, it has to be, you know, shoehorned into that box, then it's going to be a problem. Okay. As long as one is not completely free from the cause of birth and death, one cannot enter the Sanatana Dhamma, or the eternal pastimes of the Lord. One becomes envious because of being influenced by the designations of the body. But the liberated devotee has nothing to do with the body. Right? So that's again why we don't start with the designations like that. So, because otherwise, if you start on designations, where does it end? Right? Because you can say, okay, I'm American. Okay, but where? Where from America? You know, you're from the East Coast. Guys on the West Coast think you're weird. Guys on the West Coast, you know, and then the East Coast think the West Coast is weird. Everyone thinks they're from the Midwest is weird. You know, and so it just keeps going on. The North thinks the South is weird. South thinks the North is weird. Even if you're in the same city. Oh, where are you from? Oh, that side. Oh, wrong side of the tracks. You know, so it goes on and on and on and on. There's no end to it. So this whole point of starting with designations as a basis of Krishna consciousness can't be useful. That's the whole point, is what we're trying to start with Krishna consciousness, the soul, and then include the designations. Right? So, yes?
It seems to be that we have at least two kinds of preachers. One is talking about upadis, like very strongly on the point of upadis.
Right.
And one is about self.
Yes.
So, in every birth, basically, we can start from, you know, either end.
Yes.
And get a completely different result.
Yes. Yes, because what you're dealing with is that you're dealing with religion. So religion is the science of how, what is the inherent nature of something and how it functions. So then, dealing with that science, then, how do you say, you're starting, if you're touching on that point of nature, then is it about the nature itself, or is it about the engagement of the nature in the Lord's service? Right. So if it's about engagement in the Lord's service, then is it about ourselves, the benefits we get from that, or is it about the Lord being pleased by it? Right? So in the beginning, it's just going to be, we're in anxiety for some reason or another, right? Emotionally, economically, intellectually, like this, then we're going to take up Krishna consciousness. So it's about ourselves. But as we mature, then we start to see, no, it's about Krishna. And so then we're able to engage whatever we're doing nicely in Krishna's service. But then at some point, Krishna recommends sarvadharmam parityaja, that you give up all that varieties of religion. Right? So it's not about the designation. It's about engaging the designation, but it's not about the designation. Right? That's the whole thing, is that point of switching. If you're talking about pure devotional service, it's not about the designation, though you're going to work with the designation. But the other is the designation becomes the actual pivotal point, and you have to adjust Krishna consciousness to fit the designation. So that's a lower standard. So yes, it is the beginning stages of Krishna consciousness. That's how sadhana works. But it can't be preached that is standard. It is something you do. Just like when you first learn to ride a bicycle, falling off, running into things, and stuff like that, that's standard. So if someone's just, you see somebody on a bicycle and you see them careening into the fence, and you turn to the guy next to him, and he says, oh, he's just started learning. Then you, oh, okay, yeah, yeah. Great, he got 20 feet before he fell over. That's pretty good, you know. You know, how much of before? Oh, he just got on the bike and fell over, right? You know, so it's improving. But if now you say, what's with the guy? What do you mean, what's with the guy? You know, why you think you're superior because you can ride a bike nicely and not bump into the fence? No, bumping into the fence and riding nicely, they're exactly the same. How can you say it's superior? In fact, bumping in the face is more natural and all that. And so actually he's in the senior position and you're just following this because you're following this, you know, preconceived idea of what is actually advanced and things like that. And, you know, while here we're just going naturally what works and it's just about the mood and the bob and he likes bumping into fences. You know, then it's kind of like, whoa. So that's the whole thing, is that yes, these levels, and we encourage all levels, that's what karma yoga, jnana yoga are for, is how to engage the conditioning. But if we're going to say, is if we're not going to use the intelligence to distinguish between the levels and what is attachment and what's not, and what's attachment to Krishna and what's not, then we're not actually dealing with a very elevated platform. And in fact, you could probably even say is they don't even actually understand the religion they're dealing with. Because as we said, if you say Westerner, that, what do you mean by Westerner? You know, what Europeans do, they don't agree at all with Americans, you know, because if they did... Now, in Europe, who's known for culture in Europe? Brits? More French? Who kept America out of Europe? The French. World War II, it was like everyone was represented, America was going to be represented there. They said no. So, you know, so it's not that what Americans do, Europeans really appreciate. And as I said, in America, it's a very big place. There's a lot of difference there. And so this whole thing of saying that this is universal, it doesn't even work in what is even defined as the Western world. How you say? I was talking to somebody the other day, and I think they looked kind of like, they may have looked, now that I think about it, maybe Indian, but really more refined. But they spoke with a very, you know, good, you know, American accent. So I asked, you know, where they're from. They said, Canada. He says, oh, Canada. says, you know, and I was trying to say something about, you know, difference from Canadians and Americans. It says, yeah, the cultured ones. You know, we're the cultured Americans. Then there's the, you know, United States of, yeah, yeah. You know, so even there, there's a difference, right? You know, down the things, you know, those guys up there, they're too slow up there. Those guys are too crazy. So this whole idea is that it's a universal thing. It doesn't apply. So it's not even a real understanding of the religion that they're dealing with. So when one understands the science, then one can accommodate the whole thing, and then whatever's necessary, then it's used. But if to say that the beginning tools, like training wheels on the bicycle, then you know they're just as good as those who, you know, don't use them, then it's not actually, how you say, intelligent or practical. Does that make sense?
So the natural question comes is that how is the neophyte-oriented society will develop?
Because it's not a neophyte-oriented society. That's also a major mistake that's made. It's a Madhyam-oriented society. And so Madhyamas, they preach, then neophytes are there. Even though there may be more Madhyamas, it's not a Madhyama. Maybe more Kanistas. It's not a Kanista society. Just like in the Vedic society, we call it Brahminical culture. But of all the orders, the Brahmins are actually the least number. You know, it's just like, let's say I have one solid gold coin and I have a huge mountain of, you know, 10 paise coins. So it's not by volume. Volume and numbers is for Shudras. They go by numbers. While the Brahmins and Kshatriyas, they go by qualification. What's the quality that it has? So that's the difference. So to say that it's a neophyte society, where does it ever say that? Prabhupada talks about Madhyamas, the Uttamas come down to the Madhyama platform. Lord Chaitanya's mission is for preaching, so how is that neophyte? Does that make sense? So it's about the Madhyama platform, how to raise the neophytes to the Madhyama platform. That's why there's association. Does that make sense? That's the whole point of the society, to create that opportunity for association so the neophytes associated with the Madhyamas can then therefore come to the Uttama platform. And this idea is, no, they're neophytes, we have to judge everything for them, then that doesn't work. Do we adjust the whole society for the children? At the airport, the kids run around, scream and all that, that's considered perfectly normal, that's the way it should be. No, we expect it's the, you know, adult society, and the kids have to, they're young, but they have to adjust with that. So the neophytes have to adjust with the Madhyama culture. But where they're situated, that's fine. So in other words, where they are, that doesn't matter. But to say that, no, it's a neophyte culture, Kanista culture, says, no, it's never has. No authority has ever made that position. And whenever I've seen that authorities have taken that position, then it's always ended in disaster. Because it's not about that, it's about raising them. You know, kids, they would rather yell and scream. So school, is it just about kids? No, it's about adults. So it's about getting the kids to the adult platform. Is that make sense? Does that work, or... Yeah, well, that cat sees this cat. But that cat definitely doesn't like this cat getting any attention.
Yeah. Seems like this one is the boss.
I think ultimately that one's the boss. Because he's asleep, then went by, and if it was in a general thing, then they'd be in trouble. So, I mean, this is his area. That cat moves through, but I think that one's more of a boss than this one. Yes?
Can real learning take place if the student is not actually admitting his ignorance And the second part to it, how does the teacher point it out without rubbing it in, without offending, without upsetting the student or the prospective student, you could say. You're talking about Kanishas and Madhyamas.
Yes.
And whatever is the so-called norm, people feel, well, that's normal and you are abnormal. So how does that upward mobility get ensured when the emphasis is given on the individual?
But it's about the individual fitting into the group of individuals. It's not about the individual and everybody adjusting with them. That's the difference between your traditional societies and this modern, is that everybody's an individual, but there are standards. See, the modern is, to make be an individual, there has to be no standards. You have to set your own standards. But the Vedic is that, no, there are standards, but they apply them to the individual. That's why someone's very new. They, so many things they don't do, no one worries about it, because that enthusiasm is there, that inquisitiveness is there, that application is there. So that's what you encourage. In other words, where the spark is, that's what you fan. Like that. So if people are focusing on other aspects, these secondary aspects, then that's not correct. So just because people may have done that in the past, that doesn't mean that you throw out the actual system. Right?
Would you agree? Thank you. Would you agree to say that the learning happens mostly by association?
It's
and
by
the
association.
Least amount is actually in the classroom.
No, it's the Upanishads, it's one quarter is in the classroom, one quarter is from one's own study, one quarter is from others by discussing and things, and one quarter is from life's experience. So that's how it breaks it down. So if you haven't heard, how do you contemplate? Like there's the concept, do you put in or do you draw out? But then the problem is that the modern has to be one or the other. But the Vedic is you put in, and once you put in, then you can draw out. Just like a pitcher. You put something in the pitcher, now I can fill up glasses. But if I don't fill up the pitcher, I just with my sentiments say, now fill up the glasses, it won't work.
That's why it's recommended that devotees make themselves available so people can take that association.
Yes,
and
yes.
Guidance.
That's the main thing. The society is giving association. So you're trying to create association whichever way people are interested. Now, we may consider, okay, these individuals will appreciate something in this particular way. And so therefore, then they deal like that. Like when Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, his men, let's say, would go to British government officials to get something done officially, they might go in a three-piece suit with spats. And so then they'll take them seriously, they get their work done. But when that person comes back to the temple, he doesn't keep wearing that, he puts on his devotional clothes. So if they come to the temple, then they see what's there. So we may consider for that kind of aspect, but it doesn't change our own lifestyle. It means we consider their lifestyle. But the point is we're considering because they identify with it. But as they become purified, then they're supposed to stop identifying with it. It's not that they don't use it, but they stop identifying with it. Right? Because as long as you identify with something, that's where the material problem comes. So that's why, here we've been mentioning this point again and again about the designations, because it keeps coming up here. Because in this ninth canto, we're trying to get rid of even the designations that are Vedic. That I'm a Brahmin, I'm a Kshatriya. No, I'm a devotee. I may be engaging Brahminical occupation in the Lord's service or Kshatriya occupation, but I'm not a Brahmin or Kshatriya. I'm a devotee. We have to switch to that. So we've gone from Vikarma up to Karma up to pure devotional service. Right? So we're trying to make that progress. So then basically it's how... Basically, you can say is that the instruction will be given like like, let's say, for example, driving a car, right? A manual. That, how do you say it? If it's open road, it's going very nicely, but if there's any difference, you know, going uphill or some difficult thing, and that, then you have to adjust according to that. And if things aren't working nicely, then there's called the clutch. So depending upon how much can be handled is how much you put in the clutch. So if they can't handle much, you talk in one way. You know, it's in an, if they can handle more, you speak in a different way. The more direct it is, the quicker the benefit. But that's only because if they can handle the direct. So in other words, if that mood of thoughtfulness is there and submission, then, you know, that submissive inquiry or that interest to know, then one can be more straight. And if there's not, then one has to deal in such a way that something catches. Yes.
Yeah, what if oftentimes the environment is as such that people can only handle hanging out together, you know, like, because they're not used to
then
hearing a lecture, they're not used to...
Then bring prasad. And have a kirtan, because generally they can hang out and have a kirtan. So
that's how it all started.
Get yourself a pizza, offer it, and have a kirtan. You know, then by that it'll be just like Brahmananda. You know, how you say, parallels to the example may or may not be appreciated, but hey. Brahmananda, when he was preaching in Africa, then he was saying they're not interested in philosophy, but they like prasad and they like kirtan. Mm-hmm. So Prabhupada says, then you just do those. And he was saying, oh, but it's going so slow, you know, nobody's joining. And he says, but the effect of your preaching, you won't see in your lifetime. But you keep at that, then it'll generate the agyata sukriti and it will build. Because the point is when exposure to devotional service builds to a certain volume, that's when faith develops. So those who don't like to do these other things just means that hasn't developed. It means if they're engaging themselves in other activities and fully engaged, then don't worry about it. Because Krishna will reveal from within their hearts. But the point is generally it's Rupa Goswami recommends all five activities. But the point is any activity will have an effect. So if you focus on one, it will gradually include the others. Like, how do you offer prayers to the deities unless there is a deity, which means deity worship's going on? Right? So it means they all will include the other. But if it's a matter they're not interested in Krishna consciousness and this is the only thing they'll do, then you start with that. Just means the sukriti is less. Does that make sense? So the point is seeing that, then if it's about how to benefit the others, then you just see what works for them. Right? But because it works for them doesn't mean that it'll work for anybody else. You know, it'll work for that particular, when that situation is there, then it'll work. You know, no matter where it is. Does that make sense? But we shouldn't try to take that and make that into a universal principle. You know, like that. No, but I've seen my preaching, you know, they only like prasad and kirtan, so, you know, we should get rid of all these other things. They scare them away. You know, then they'll be more attracted and, you know, on and on and on like this. No, they're only, if you have pizza and you have a kirtan, they'll be attracted. Otherwise, they won't be. So it's not that these other things scare them away, they're just not interested. But what about those people that are interested? And then we're going to say they're the same? Okay. So. Okay. Okay. One becomes envious because of being influenced by the designations of the body. It means one's own conditioning. Right? But the liberated devotee has nothing to do with the body, and therefore he is completely on the transcendental platform. A devotee is never envious of anyone, even his enemy, because the devotee knows that the Lord is his supreme protector. He thinks, what harm can the so-called enemy do? Thus a devotee is confident about his protection. The Lord says, Ye yatamam prapadyante tamstataiva bhajamyaham. Bhagavad Gita 4.11. According to the proportion of one's surrender unto me, I respond accordingly. A devotee must therefore be completely free from envy, especially of other devotees. To envy other devotees is a great offense, a Vaishnava aparad. A devotee who constantly engages in hearing and chanting, Shravanam Kirtanam, is certainly free from the disease of envy, and thus he becomes eligible to go back home, back to Godhead. So that Krishna responds according to how we surrender, then that shows that there are different levels. And then there's within the means there's the different tastes. So even you come up to the perfectional platform, then there's different tastes within that. But getting to that, then there's different levels. So that being appreciated is still about the Lord, His reciprocation. So we're thinking, no, it's about me engaging. That's nice. But actually it's about Krishna reciprocating. That's what we're trying to get used to, is that it's happening because He reciprocates. Yes?
So it seems that unless we are free of envy, we cannot go back home.
Unless we're free from envy, we can't go back to Godhead, no.
Especially
the devotees. Like that. But it doesn't mean at the time of death, if one fully surrenders at that time and gives that up, that one doesn't go back to Godhead. It just means that one hasn't practiced it very nicely. You know, so you kind of, how you say, the typical maverick doesn't have any training, but at the last moment, in the need point, you know, the moment of need, then somehow or another comes through, like that. So, for many of us, then, you know, how you say, Kripa Siddha is greatly hoped for. Yes.
In Upanishadrita, Srila Prabhupada mentioned that Uttama Dipari is the one who gave, you know, completely propensity to criticize others.
Yes.
He has no envy.
Yes. So the Madhyama means something's there, but it'll be less than the neophyte. The neophyte, generally, it's so strong that it actually stops advancement. While for the Madhyama, then it's a point that one has to be careful of. Like that. If one lets it get out of hand, of course, you know, just it means at any point if one lets things get out of hand, it'll be a problem. But that's what it means, not nirmatsaranam. That's the special quality. Because if you see Krishna and you have affection for Krishna, everything's connected to Krishna, all living entities are connected with Krishna being his energy, then where would be the envy? Because if you don't envy Krishna, then you can't envy anything else because it's all Krishna. That's the point. All these different points in the philosophy, these are all actual perspectives. We think, you know, they're just nice prayers. You know, you're a great guy, you're a fabulous guy, you're a swell guy, and hey, you're really neat. But they actually mean something, you know. So he said, you're there before the creation means, you know, he's the original. He's not dependent upon everything. Well, we're not. We depend on the creation. Like that. Without the creation, our activities are not manifest. We're just asleep. So he is in it. All these things mean something. So that's the idea, is that we catch that. So yes, it means that the Madhyama has come to grips with it, that it's workable. It's not. It can not get in the way of his advancement. But for the neophyte, the tendency is it tends to get in the way. That's why then, you know, Gramikata, all these things are avoided. But it may be a matter of just, you know, winding it down. And the more you can do that, then the better things will go. Though, there is the aspect of third-class pure devotee, which means they're nicely situated in devotional service by realization, but they just don't know much scripture. You know, they have that faith in Krishna, that commitment to Krishna. They just don't know much scripture. So you have to designate in that group. Does that make sense?
Do we have any examples like those?
Kashi Mishra. He's given an example in Chaitanya Charitamrita as a third-class pure devotee. It's just because he's not very Shastric. So when he met, I think it was the Prakashananda Saraswati, they were criticizing Lord Chaitanya. He didn't know what to say, so he just left. You know, so then it was mention is that in here, then you're saying the neophyte doesn't know any scripture. The Madhyama is quite solid in scripture, but sometimes he can be defeated, meaning that he doesn't know what to say to argue with something. The Uttama can never be defeated because they only see Krishna. So anything anybody says, they see Krishna in it, while the other person is saying doesn't see Krishna, so they can always catch them. It's not that they're more scholastic at argument. It's just that the whole point of everything being Krishna and being committed to Krishna, they can always see that point. So therefore, even someone who seems to be not a scholar, there's no one on the planet that could defeat them, or in the universe, that is a scholar and not a devotee. Like that. So that's one of the ways. The other is that the neophyte occasionally chants, you know, like that. The Madhyama, then he's generally regularly chanting, you know, not just, you know, in his what he's supposed to. And the Uttama, by seeing him, you chant. And then I think, faith is, what is it? The Uttama will never give up the faith of Madhyama. What is it? The Madhyama? What is it? The neophyte, then you may defeat him in argument and his faith will be shaken.
The Madhyama, you can defeat him, but his faith will
become shaken, yeah. So they're all kind of connected. So these are the three ways that I think Chaitanya Charitamrita identifies the... So then by that one of knowledge of Shastra, that would be, then in that case, then Kashi Mishra would be considered a neophyte. But as far as realization, he's an eternal associate, so it's slightly, you know, but they're giving an example of the... Yes?
How can one detect that there's envy in kind of constructive criticism of devotees in our society?
No, but what would be the need?
No.
Means what would be the need of identifying? Means that, why would you want to identify?
I mean, in my own case, it's like, is this good association or is this good for me?
Oh, okay. Then the point is what's the benefit of the criticism? Will it bring the person to a better level of Krishna consciousness? Does that make sense? If by the point that's made, will the other person following that be benefited in Krishna consciousness? That would be one aspect. The other aspect is, are they in a position that they actually could have an effect? But if it's just that one doesn't like something or this and that and making comments, then that's the association you avoid.
It's sad because there's so many criticisms.
But that's always what we mentioned, is that the neophyte tends to criticize, find fault, because of envy. Because it's basically, one is in one's position, the one's in not as a devotee. One becomes a devotee. What's all that switched is one's consciousness. But one's habit, one's practices and everything still remains. Then by practicing Krishna consciousness, that becomes purified, so what's not necessarily starts to drop off. So in the beginning, you may see that whatever is their background, that's what they walk in with.
Sometimes they are very, very old devotees, and they are the most criticism.
That's another thing. That's called that's just
like
called being grumpy. That's just part of being old. You know, it's just because you have this thing is that I remember meeting one. He was in London. He was considered the top eye doctor. So I was supposed to see one of his, you know, one of his that, you know, students who was, you know, very good. You know, you can and well established, you can understand how old this other guy is. But he wasn't available, so it was arranged that I would see this guy. And then one of the first things he said, basically pointed out, he says, I'm just too old now. Not for doing the work. I'm just too old to sit and just talk this and that. He says, I would rather be right than be appreciated. In other words, you do have those that might be critical just because they're just straightforward and just are just tired of putting up with, you know, just so much stuff that's not so important.
Some temples are like with them. So when you bring new devotee and they are there and they are saying stuff to do because they are old and like...
But whatever it is. But the point is then either you cultivate them first and that they know what's the situation and say, hey, people here are a bit grumpy. It's the way it is. You know, we're our society, you know, everybody can join. So there's no rule if you're grumpy, you can't join Krishna consciousness. So when you come to the temple, you'll see some grumpiness. Right? So then they're prepared. Or there's plenty of other temples. Whatever works. So you don't worry that they're grumpy. You worry about your Krishna consciousness. Because what they're saying, is there any value to it? They're being critical, but if you followed it, if you followed it and practiced it in your life, would you benefit? So in other words, is it correct? It may not have that social presentation that would make it nice, but is it correct?
It's correct.
Yes, so that's what we're saying. Some individuals, as they get older, they just don't like dealing with things that aren't direct. Right, which you can't complain on one level, because to be able to deal with all those final things, then they have to be involved in everything. But especially, you'll see if they keep a very simple lifestyle, eat simple, dress simple, keep hardly anything, you know, and just engage in direct activities of devotional service, they've pared it down, so they're not dealing with the social at all. So sometimes they're also socially not very inspiring. You understand?
Yeah.
But if they have this whole social scene going on and they're grumpy, we got a problem. Okay? Yeah. Yes.
So criticism generally will be one of two things. One, we're doing it for educational purposes, but generally we're doing it because we're actually having insecurity ourselves.
Yes, yes. Insecurity or the other side is superiority or... You know, something. You know, in other words, if you're insecure, by criticizing, you bring yourself up. And if you're secure, then by criticizing, you keep everybody else down. In any case, you know, it works.
So you're actually, because you're thinking, you're criticizing because you want change, but you're actually not making any change whatsoever, because...
Yeah, means unless you have power. Now, I've seen someone who is influential, and I was asking about how do they start something going, something that no one thinking about. How do you get that moving? He says, first put it out in the ether. First you just start talking about it, then people hear about it and all that. And then once it's kind of there and people talk, then you affect it. Because if you try immediately, no one even knows what you're doing. But once it becomes something people are thinking about, then you make the effort and then you can do it. But that was someone who could do that. But if they just talk and nothing happens, then it may be, you know, desire for something of better and this and that, but at the same time as the critical won't necessarily get it done. You know, that's what we're saying about this middle quasi-intellectual group, that's their main method of... You know, change is just talking about change that they themselves can't affect.
Because in the modern academy, we're trained to have this kind of critical analysis.
Yeah. Well, that's because you want to prove that what you're doing is better than anybody else.
Right.
You know, but it's not necessarily about actual truth.
Yeah.
It's just about, you know, perceived truth. Okay. Myers Prickett inquired from Sukadev Goswami, how did the Lord conduct himself, and how did he behave in relation with his brothers, who were expansions of his own self, and how did his brothers and the inhabitants of Ayodhya treat him? Right, so now down to we've seen the glories of the Lord, now how the cultural aspects, how those apply. Yeah. Verses 25 to 36, the opulence of Ayodhya. Sri Sukadev Goswami continued, after accepting the throne of the government by the fervent request of his younger brother Bharata, Lord Ramachandra ordered his younger brothers to go out and conquer the entire world, while he personally remained in the capital to give audience to all the citizens and residents of the palace and supervise the governmental affairs with his other assistants. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur comments. He ordered his brothers to conquer the world. His brothers gave up his personal association and followed his order. That was their conduct towards him. Ram, out of affection to his brothers, gave them dominion over those lands. That was his conduct towards them. His conduct towards his relatives and citizens was letting them see him directly and glancing on them with mercy. He supervised the city. That was his conduct. Right? So in other words, him sending them out means what they were going and conquering the world, that's what they controlled. Right? So it's not like the Western or the modern concept of you send your brothers out means you get rid of them. Here you send them out and what they conquer, that's what they control. Right? Because someone has to manage that. So they've conquered it, they manage it. And he just sees to the central that it's all being managed in a cooperative way so that it all works together. And then towards the relative citizens, then he's dealing with them very nicely, very pleasantly, like that. Right. Yes?
The example of Lord Ramachandra, because it's something that impossible to find in the material world as such. Mm. It's to give us this real ideal, standard, how it's supposed to be.
Yes, means this is what works. You see, it works so well that even it mentions there's no kind of pestilence, disease, you know, no one is hungry or thirsty, no one even got old, no one even died if they didn't want to. Right, you know, nowadays everyone would say, I never want to die, but there, you've lived a life, you've done all the different things and that, you're ready, because by dying they go back to Godhead, so, mm-hmm. like
I
that.
I also try that, you go on 1,000 years, you kind of get tired.
No, that would be 10,000 years.
10,000.
Yeah, 10,000.
Sorry. Even more.
Even more. Yeah, really tired, right? So you know, we're getting grumpy when we're 60, 70. You can imagine that being 600. Stuff. Oh, he's a little grumpy. He's 700, you know.
Seven thousand.
Yeah. So, yes, it's the standard. And by so the closer you get to that, the better things worse. I mean, better things work. What's going on? Just think of the opulence of the Ayodhya Prakashika. Okay. Srila Prabhupada comments. The Supreme Personality of Godhead does not allow any of his devotees or assistants to be engaged in sense gratification. The younger brothers of Lord Ramachandra were at home enjoying the personal presence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but the Lord ordered them to go out and achieve victory all over the world. It was the custom, and this custom in some places is still current, that all other kings would have to accept the supremacy of the emperor. If the king of a small state did not accept the emperor's supremacy, there would be a fight, and the king of the state would be obliged to accept the emperor as supreme. Otherwise, it would not be possible for the emperor to rule the country. Right? So, he's ruling the whole thing. So the idea is the whole earth should be done nicely. So then you have these kings that can do a particular area. I think at the end of the Raj, they had, I forget, it was like 900 some odd kings in India. And one of them, he had something like, I think it was, I can't remember, it was 6,000 or 10,000 acres of land. That was his full kingdom. That was it. So, you know, that's what he could manage. And others could manage like Punjab and like Hyderabad. They were huge. Like that. So, all these kings work under someone who can see to the greater benefit, like Yudhishthira and that. They can see to the world. So then, like that, it'll just keep going up. So you might even have emperors within the things, like Jarasandha was, you know, in his area, someone else in there. But then there's someone who's on top of all of them. Right? So then the whole thing works very, very nicely.
What?
Yes.
The side point, when this Raj was ended, so what did they all do? They didn't die, all the kings.
No, no, they just basically carried on doing nothing. But because they had means they allowed them their privy purses, so they had all their money, but they had no authority, no political authority. And then I think it was Gandhi's daughter,
Indira.
Then she took away their money also, and then they had to get jobs or open businesses. No, in other words, they weren't able to run the government, so they were losing money, so they had to take all their money.
They became like zamindars, and they were running through that system, and then she removed that. She took away all the land of people.
Yeah. Yeah, so like that. So that's the problem. You know, so that's what we mean, what we were saying yesterday when it says it's about Swaraj, about following their own culture. No. Like the British means in areas of their own law, it was according to British law. But when it was dealing with Indians, and their things, they actually used Manu. They would adjudicate that based on that. Yes.
Thank you. In relation to our administrative process, now these kings, they're just concerned about their kingdom. At
yes.
the same time, they respect the emperor because he knows he's good for them.
Right, right.
So it works both ways. So now we have the GBC system. Is the GBC supposed to be a visionary who is concerned for the greater good of ISKCON and to carry on the preaching mission of Mahaprabhu, or a person who is primarily concerned about his geographical area and what happens there? Or is it a person who can do both and that's why they're a GBC?
As Prabhupada envisioned it, it was that they are Brahmins who perform the Brahminical activities. Basically, they preach and expand the movement and see to the standards being followed in what's already established. Like means in the temples in their zone that are already established, they see that the standards are being maintained. Krishna consciousness is dynamically moving forward. And in areas of their zone where there aren't temples in that, that's what they establish. Because generally most temple presidents don't want to open another temple. Right? So that's the GBC's business. And then the temple president, he sees that whatever he's in charge, that works very, very nicely.
So they're preachers and visionaries and not primarily administrators.
No, they're preachers and, what did you say? Preachers and visionaries and absolutely not administrators.
Now the GBC course is more geared towards MBA, it's more administrative, a duty officer, a person who
can
hold a post and...
Good luck. The point is how do you say? What's that British one about the test of the puddings and the tasting? Or what?
Yeah.
Means it's like they've been doing this for 20 years and still wet paper bags have not been perforated. You know, so therefore, how is this the direction? Means Prabhupada envisioned, and why MBA? That's a business, that's a corporate management. If we're talking about governance, administration, that has to be Kshatriya things. They should be studying Manu and those kind of things. So to do corporate, then how would that have anything to do with ISKCON? You know, because corporate is for making money, and corporate is also not, voluntary. And then the final point is, if you really want to go corporate, then you have to have the shareholders can remove lock, stock, and barrel all the directors.
Well, that's what happens in a lot of the temples who are managed by corporate interests, by the money.
No, but I'm saying just the general devotee should be able to remove the whole GBC if you want to use a corporate model. But since that's a corporate model, because the devotees are the shareholders. So if they get together and vote, do they want the GBC to continue or not, then that would be corporate. But since Prabhupada says no, that's lifelong, then we're not talking corporate here. And if we say lifelong, they can't be administrators, because administrators have to retire at 50. So the only thing that continues all the way through is brahminical activities. So by default there, GBCs have to be Brahmins. So that's the whole point. But it doesn't mean that they don't poke their nose into it. Like Vashishtha is a Rajguru. It's not that he can't poke his nose, but if there's no need. It's only if there's a weakness, then he may look. But to say, oh, they're administrators and this and that. But otherwise, this other thing, good luck. You can teach them for the next 50 years and they won't learn. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaura Premanand ki.